Okay, welcome to Introduction to Modern Cryptography. This course, thank you so much. This course is, as the title says, about cryptography. Today, we have two sessions. The first session starts with a brief overview of what we will talk about, organizational questions and aspects that you have to keep in mind. The second part is just a little bit of motivation. As you will see throughout the first 3-4 weeks, things can be a little bit theoretical and dry. And for that reason, it makes sense to have an idea of why this is relevant. And two of the most important cryptographic protocols that we know today are the TLS protocol that we use for web surfing and basically everything, but this is the most relevant and known topic or use case application, and the double ratchet, which is basically the standard protocol for messaging today. So it's the foundation and the basis of the WhatsApp Messenger, Signal Messenger, iMessage, and most of the other messengers as well. And in the exercise that you will have until next week, you will have the opportunity to take a look into these two protocols, into their specifications, and identify the cryptographic building blocks that they are based on. So just to be sure, I think it makes sense to speak English today. And also, we have a recording, so next semester we'll also, or next year, we'll be happy to have an English recording. And I have had a couple of requests to speak in English, so I hope that makes sense. Yes. Okay. So TLS double ratchet, you will first take a look at those two protocols to get an idea of why the building blocks that we will look at in the first couple of weeks are relevant. Nevertheless, I told you it's going to be about the theory behind cryptography. So we will not only look at constructions, but also look at definitions, understand how to estimate what security means, how to understand how to analyze security, and so on and so forth. And at the very end of today's first session, I will give you an overview of the weeks that are laying ahead. Okay, so first things first, overview and motivation. Overview and motivation. So, pro for you, or advantage for you, everything is recorded, and I will upload these notes here as PDFs. Disadvantage, my handwriting, as you can see, is not optimal, but that basically means that you either have to look up what I said in the recording again, or you take your own notes. And what is typically very helpful is taking your own notes. So first of all, I write pretty normal, so the speed is not very high, and this leaves room for you to also take notes. And typically, if you also try to make notes, you try to make sense of what I wrote there. And as soon as you see that there might be something that doesn't make sense to you, you start thinking about what I wrote there. And this thinking helps you actually understanding the contents of this course. So, who am I? I am Paul Rösler. And I have been starting to work at FIU roughly 3 years ago. So I established the so-called Real World Crypto Group in 2022 at FIU. And before that, I did a postdoc, which basically means some kind of research at New York University. At TU Darmstadt. And I did my PhD at Ruhr University Bochum. So, Ruhr University Bochum is one of the biggest cryptography universities in Germany. So I had the big opportunity to learn a lot of different perspectives of what cryptography means. And I try to distill and bring all of those things that I've learned into this course. And for that reason, I will talk about these two books in a second. Those two books are the things from which I took the contents of this course. This here is a more practical perspective, Understanding Cryptography by Christoph Pahl, Tim Günesu, and Jan Pelzel. And I would say it always has good examples. So you will always have examples with small integers. So for example, if you want to understand how RSA works or how Diffie-Hellman works, you always have examples with prime numbers like 17 or so. So you can actually calculate these algorithms with small examples that are, of course, not secure, but they give you an example of how the big examples work with integers of 128 bits or longer. This here is a more theoretic work a textbook, Introduction to Modern Cryptography by Jonathan Katz and Yehuda Lendel. And I would say it's the standard book that teaches you how to work with cryptography, how to understand cryptography. And most of the contents are taken from that book, but some of the contents are taken from the other book. And at some points, I may diverge from both of these contents, especially when I define security. We will see all of those things. I try to make sure that you actually can look up where I take these things from. So whenever I write something down about actual cryptographic contents, I will give you the page numbers of these two books. Or if it is not taken from a book, I will give you the papers. Okay. Welcome. So maybe just a quick add-on to what I am working on and what you can work on with me if you work together with me, for example, on theses or in seminars. So the most important work that I do is provable security in general. So if we talk about TLS and double ratchet and all other types of cryptography, what I do is I take a look at them, I try to define security, and then I prove that these types of definitions are satisfied for those type of constructions. And as I said, typically I look at real protocols. So there is a lot of cryptography everywhere. Some people just brew their own cryptography, and that basically means there is a lot of tasks to be done to actually analyze whether these protocols achieve reasonable definitions of security. However, there are some things that I work on that do not directly have something to do with real protocols. For example, I try to understand how to define security in a meaningful manner, or how to automate the validation of security definitions, and I would call that theoretic foundations. And lastly, most of the things that I do are related to secure messaging, because secure messaging has a lot of, you can just come in, or you can gerne reinkommen. We have a lot of space, and I'm sure next week we'll have fewer people sitting here. And then in 3 weeks, even fewer. So secure messaging is typically... the typical application or motivation, which I use to analyze things, to produce things for, and so on, because that's a very complex primitive that contains a lot of different requirements, features, and so on. Okay, now, first thing that is relevant for organization, I already said that in the email. Please, if you have any questions, use the forum that is on the Sturon page. This makes replying very easy for me, because some of the questions that I received them multiple times. So whenever you have a question, just reach out to me via the forum. Maybe others already have an answer to that. And you can also use that for actual cryptographic questions, in particular before preparing for the exam or during preparing for the exam. So the forum is really useful. I am basically a one-man brigade, so I have to take care of all of these emails. And if you see that I maybe receive like 10 to 20 emails just for this course, it's a lot of work that I need to spend, and probably I can use that more efficiently for answering those things once. There are still two seats, one is there and one is there, and also three seats in the front row. Okay, please use the forum. And now more annoying organizational things. So the lecture and the exercise both give 2.5 ECTS. There was a lecture 3 years ago or 2 years ago that also like that had two lecture sessions per week and one exercise session per week, and that one gave 7.5 ECTS. There is also still a recording for that course online. But the topics, they slightly overlap, but they do not overlap entirely. So we have a new recording now, thanks to Yannis, who is making sure that we have the recording. You can take a look online, and nobody forces you to be here, but it makes sense to be here. So, I think everything about that was already said. So, literature, I already introduced these two books to you. Literature. Number one and most important is Introduction to Modern Cryptography. Intro to Modern Crypto by Katz and Lindell. And this is the revised third edition. And there are both exemplars, like books of that, of both books in physical, in the library of the FAU, but also digital versions. So you can just take a look at them, find them online, and work with them. But you can also buy them. I think this year is relevant for while you stay at university. For example, if you ever do a PhD in cryptography, this is a really good book for that. But if you go to industry, this year is also really relevant because it has a good overview of all modern cryptographic algorithms in a practical understanding, understandable manner. So buying that book is not too expensive, and it's like both of them already have post-quantum cryptography in them, and we will actually have a session on post-quantum cryptography later in the semester. So consider buying them. And this is not advertisement, so I just know the authors of both of them, and I've used these books intensely to prepare that lecture, and they are really very easily readable. Okay, exercises. So, the basic idea is that these exercises are used to repeat the contents of the course. So basically, we will have the normal course. Today we have an exception, so twice a lecture session, but typically we first have an exercise session to repeat the things from last week, and then we will have a lecture session to start with the new stuff. So exercises are meant for repetition, for preparation. They are meant to give you some practical perspectives. Sometimes we don't have enough time to have the full proofs for something in the lecture session, so we will have full proofs in the exercises. We will use it for discussions and for Q&A. So I've heard that there are a couple of students who have overlapping sessions with the exercise session. I'm sorry to hear that. Nobody's forced to be here, so you can be wherever you want to. But this is like the exercise session is the place where we can have extensive discussions about everything. So if you have a big question, maybe consider to once come here for the overlapping course, I don't know, once every 4 weeks, and use the time here, listen to what the others have to say. And I will offer you, of course, to speak to me during the lecture break or after the lecture and stuff. So you can always feel free to contact me also via the forum. But yeah, the exercise session sessions are basically the thing where things can be discussed in detail. And there will not be a recording of the exercise sessions, which basically makes sure that everybody feels comfortable asking things, also things for which they don't feel very comfortable asking them. So this is the time where basically we interact with each other. Okay, there will be homework sheets. And they will be submitted or uploaded every 2 weeks. And these exercise sheets are basically a preparation for the exam. So if you take a look at these tasks, you will get an idea of how the exam looks like, what type of questions there are for the exam, and how you can prepare for the exam. New this semester is that we also have online exercises. So you basically have an online form where you have where we try to translate these PDF exercise sheets into. There is still a seat. These online sheet, these PDF sheets into online automatic correctable tasks. And with these online homework that you can submit via Studon, you can get up to 0.7 points for the final exam grade in case you pass the exam. So you first have to pass the exam, and if you pass the exam, you get these up to 0.7 points on top of that. So just let's take notes. New this semester is online tasks. And since this is new this semester, we will be very friendly to you in terms of correction of these online tasks. And that also means that if you find a bug or if there is something that you really don't understand, please reach out to Mahivi, who is making sure that these things work. And so report problems. To lucas.meisner@fau.de. And now, final organizational topic is the exam at the end. First question is always what it is. What is it based on? It is based on the entire course. Which means lecture and exercises. As I said earlier, the style of the task in the exam will be based on the homework sheets. And the exam is scheduled for the 17th of February 26. From 14:15 to 15:45. And you will be able to take a handwritten a four sheet of notes. Yes. Dankeschön. Okay. Yes.
If the lectures now held in English, will the exam also be in English?
Yes. Yes, and I think you will get like at least comfortable with the type of task, because also the exercises will be written in English. I think this will be natural. Yeah.
The handwritten A4 sheet, can we write on both sides?
Yes. Okay. Since language is a topic, and I know sometimes you don't feel super comfy with English, I'm super happy with respond every question that you have in any language that you ask it in. So I only speak English and German, so this is the limitation that I have, but it's perfectly fine for me if you ask questions in German, and I will of course try to translate them as much as I can in English. I just can tell you that for myself it was, when I was a student, super helpful to have lectures in English, because they actually taught me to speak in English. So when I just recently looked up my high school exam, or my high school sheet of grades, and I think I had a 4 in English basically, or 4+ or something, so I barely passed my English in high school. But during studies, I increased my strength in speaking English and reading and writing English. And so those type of courses, they help you to learn it, and it also makes things more inclusive for all the students who don't come from Germany. But yeah, nevertheless, everybody is welcome to ask things in German, and there is no issue with that. Any other questions on the organizational side? Because after that, we will now jump into actual cryptography. Yeah. So my plan is to always start at 2 p.m. Who would like to start at 2:15? Is it a deal breaker? For who is it a deal breaker if we don't start at 2:15? Like, is it just more comfortable, or is it actually necessary to come early to come late? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 people. Okay. that's the first question. I think the second question might be even more relevant. Who of you will not be able to attend the exercise session in general because there is an overlapping something? Okay, 2 people. That's not too problematic. So first exercise, then lecture. Yeah, typically. Okay. Then I think we will keep it at that. Maybe I will start like 5 to 2, or maybe 10 minutes later or something. Janis typically needs to set up the video camera, so I think, and I'm not, like, at the very beginning, I will typically just repeat what we did last week. And so if you're well prepared, you can miss that for a couple of seconds. All right, any other organizational questions? Nothing. Perfect. Then we can start with cryptography. So, simple examples. So, the first simple example that is introduced in every cryptography class, which is the first simple example, the historic oldest that we typically use to motivate how cryptography works. What is the first example? Any ideas of people who, please? Yes, Caesar cipher, exactly. And if you want to learn about the Caesar cipher, you can take a look at the Katz-Lindell book. Katz-Lindell book is this theoretic book here, which is the primary book that I talked about. Katz-Lindell book, on pages 8 and following, and you can take a look at the Paar book, so Paar, Pelzel and Günesu, on pages 7 and following. And this will be the short written notes on which pages to look at in these two books, and I will try to keep that consistent throughout the entire lecture. So, the basic idea that we want to have for some user Alice. To communicate with some user Bob. Confidentially, which basically means that Alice sends a message. Is there a question? Okay. So, the basic idea of encryption is that we have some user Alice who wants to talk to Bob, and we have an attacker. And the attacker wants to learn about the content of the message that Alice sends to Bob. We will talk about more foundational and theoretical ideas of how to model those things and specify and define those things later today. But this is the basic principle. And Caesar, at least this is what we know from history, Caesar used the following idea for encrypting his messages. He used a letter-based encryption. So he basically had a device with two circles. And on these two circles, there were the letters A, B, C, and so on to X, Y, Z. And he had the same on the inner ring, so the inner circle. And using those two circles, he shifted those to actually flip one or change one letter into a different letter. So one of those shiftings could have been that there was K, L, M, and O, which were used instead of Y, Z, A, B, and C. And so whenever Alice wanted to send a message, she looked up what the letters would mean by taking A, for example, seeing, okay, A would be replaced with M, and then replacing these letters individually. Bob basically had the same circle, but he read the circles just in reverse. So he first took a look at the inner circle, seeing or searching for the letter that he wanted to replace, and then found the outer letter that it was replaced to, and then, yeah, knowing how the encryption to decryption works. So basically, A in this encryption scheme is encrypted to M, and when M is received, it is decrypted back to A. B is encrypted to N, C is encrypted to O, and so on, Y to K, and Z to L. Same on the other side. Okay, but what were the problems of that? So, what are the problems? What could be the problems of this encryption scheme? I guess most of you have heard of problems of that. Just feel free to raise your hand. Mm-hmm. Very good. So this is the last point on the list. Are there simpler points of problems? Yes, please.
If you know that this method was used, you could just try all of the 25 possible options until you find the correct one.
Exactly. There is a very small key space that is very good. And the first problem that doesn't become obvious from what I wrote down here was that Caesar basically always used the same key. So he always used the same, the key 3. In this case here, he would have used always the key 12. So the 12th key, so A is replaced with the 12th letter in the, with the 13th letter in the alphabet. So basically, the encryption here, so encryption of K, M to C is basically that C is set to M plus K modulo 26, and the fixed key here that we use would be 12. Then the second problem that we've just heard is that there are only 26 keys. And that basically means that we can very efficiently and simply do a brute force / exhaustive key search attack. Okay, then we heard about the frequency analysis already. Which is that a letter E is in the German and in the English alphabet more often than the Y. By the way, if you can't read anything, I just heard that. If you can't read anything, you can actually raise your hand because that helps everybody. So probably you're not the only one who can't read it. But of course, you can do that also by yourself. Yeah. C is assigned to M plus K modulo 26. Exhaustive key search, aka exhaustive key search. Yeah, you're welcome. More often. And one can even extend that. So just by using E as the marker and understanding, okay, E is super often, then I see that, I don't know, the replacement of E is also super often, then I typically know this is E. But there are also combinations of letters that are more often in some languages than in others, or that are just generally more often than other combinations of letters. So this frequency analysis can be very complex, and it can help us even further than just knowing that E is the most often used letter in the language. And for this, I have prepared a graphic. And if we zoom in on this graphic, we basically see that depending on the letter, on the language, so it starts with Esperanto, Spanish, Portuguese, Italian, French, English, and so on, we have different frequencies for different letters. And if we know context information about which language we are actually trying to decrypt a ciphertext from, we can use these frequencies to more efficiently break the CISA cipher. Of course, nobody is using the CISA cipher anymore, but we will see that there are actually also more modern examples of this problem. Another graphic that will become relevant again in, like, I don't know, 5 or 6 weeks is this Tux penguin, which basically corresponds to more or less the same problem, that if I use encryption, where the plain text together with a key, so for example white together with a key, encrypts always to the same ciphertext, then just this pattern will tell me what the plain text behind that was. So if, for example, black with a certain key always maps to this kind of whatever pixel, and white with the key corresponds to this year, but still we have a much more elaborate and more secure block cipher underlying, we still have problems that this correspondence can help us reveal something about the underlying plain text. Okay, now quickly, let's quickly write down what the decryption of the CISA cipher is. So decryption of K, C signed to M. What is that? Quick question, quick answer. How do I decrypt the message from the ciphertext? Yes. M is C plus K, you're saying? Okay, and then generation of, so I just want you to get used to algorithm names. So the generation of a key is very easy here. So a key is that just sampled uniformly at random. From the set of the first 26 integers, which basically means from the set of 0 to 25, and that's the key. Yes?
Is that dollar as a sample from general notation?
Yes, at least general notation in my lecture notes. Okay. You will realize that both of these books, but all of the papers in the entire literature, always basically have their own notation. I will try to be very consistent in my own lecture notes, but you will see that it is important to very quickly adapt to different notations. Yeah. Okay, second very simple example of cryptography that went wrong is the Enigma. Which is mentioned in the PAR book on page 2. Who has heard of the Enigma? Okay, very good. There is actually an Enigma model somewhere here at FAU. I always forget where it is, but there is, I think, one of the group in the informatics tower. Yeah, might be. Yeah, LS3. So you mean like okay, Rechnerarchitektur. The group of Rechnerarchitektur, they produced, I think, with a 3D printer, they produced an Enigma. So, anybody wants to see it, go there. What was the Enigma? The Enigma was used by the Nazis in World War II. And it looked like that. then Polish. And British cryptanalysts. Reduced the strength of the encryption of the Enigma. Another problem was that the Nazis reused keys. And there were a couple of known plaintexts. For example, there were statements written or submitted via or with the Enigma, first encrypted with the Enigma and then submitted via whatever types of via cable and via wireless communication that always started with the same plaintext. And if you know that the same key or a different key was used and a different key was used but the same plaintext, you could have used that to just at least verify if the key that you found in your exhaustive brute force key search was the right one if you match it to the right plaintext. Or there were super long messages or super long words that were encrypted that were very specific to the Nazis, like, I don't know, let's say, I don't know if it was true, but something like Oberfeldwebel or something, you know that this is a word in German. If you find that word, then you know, okay, this seems to be a German real message. So, the one who got famous with that and who got famous for many other more important things is Alan Turing. And if you haven't seen it yet, it makes sense and it is interesting to watch at least the movie, The Imitation Game. Okay. Now, enough with the anecdotes. Some systematization. So, cryptology. Cryptology is the generic term that we work under. So, and cryptology basically means something like studying secrets. And then there are two very important branches of cryptology, and we will focus on the left of those two branches. By the way, if the light is too bright for anybody, we can like lower the curtains. I will let it run until I wrote down. So, the branch that we work with is cryptography. So, cryptology is studying secrets. Cryptography is concerned with designing constructions and proof security. So this is what we do in this course. We will, first of all, look at existing constructions. We will understand why they can be proven secure. And maybe also, towards the end of the course, you have an idea of how to proceed if you want to design a construction. On the other side, we have cryptanalysis. And cryptanalysis is concerned with breaking assumptions and constructions. So whenever we try to prove something, there are very, very few examples where we don't use assumptions. Typically, we need some complexity assumptions, and the reason why we believe that these assumptions are correct is because cryptanalysts tried for a very long time to break them and they didn't succeed. And they had good arguments for not succeeding, but they don't have a proof. So for most of the things that we build in cryptography, there is no foundation, there is no fixed foundation with a proof that tells us that these things are really secure. The strongest foundation that we typically have is that some group of cryptanalysts, they looked at that for a long time, and then we believe that they were smart enough to exclude all the reasonable attacks. So a field where this is currently very important, and we will hear about that later in the last third of the course, is post-quantum cryptography. So most of the assumptions that we use today for building post-quantum secure cryptography, the assumptions that we use there are maybe 10, maybe 20 years old. There are older assumptions, but they don't lead to very efficient constructions. And that's the reason why we try to come up with new assumptions. But the problem with very new and very young assumptions is that cryptanalysts, they didn't have long time to look at them and trying to break them. And for that reason, cryptography conferences today, they consist also of long sessions of new attacks, new, better, improved attacks on some of the assumptions, which sometimes then leads to some of the post-quantum constructions that have been developed in the last couple of years to become insecure, or they have been insecure forever, but now we know that some of them are insecure. And so I am at least very happy that there are these people who look at those things and have looked at those things. It's super complicated, but we don't look at that. We just are thankful that they did that job for us to have somewhat a foundation for the things that we do here, which is proving security. So, final thing to be noted, the IACR, which is basically an international group of, or the international organization under which cryptology, cryptography, cryptanalysis is organized, all conferences are organized, basically publishing of research papers is organized, is the IACR, and the IACR is the International Association of Cryptologic Research. Now something very fundamental, still abstract and high level, for motivating why the things that we do here, they really matter, is Kerckhoff's principle. Did anybody hear of Kerckhoff's principle before? Some of you. Okay. Can anybody quickly phrase what Kerckhoff's principle says?
I think it's about that the knowledge of the encryption algorithm shouldn't break the security of an encryption. So basically the key should be the only thing that's getting you access to the decryption.
Yes, basically that more or less says that. I will just write down the phrase because I think it's very fundamental. It's somewhat related to open source concepts, but not directly, because there is open source software that does not have to do anything with security, but rather with functionality and stuff. So the same principles do not, like, it's not very the same principle, but it's very fundamental to anything that has to do with security, cryptography, and everything with confidentiality and what we are looking at here in this course. So a cryptographic construction should be secure even if the adversary which is the word that we use here for the more common word or the simpler word attacker knows all details about the construction with the exception of the secret key of secret key material in particular all algorithms should be publicly known. So when we look at encryption again, and decryption, where encryption takes as input a message and a key, and decryption takes as input the ciphertext and the key to output the message, and we have the adversary sitting on the wire trying to decrypt the ciphertext back to the message. This adversary should know everything, but it should not learn the key. Because with the key, of course, we can do the decryption trivially, but without the key, in particular with knowledge about how the encryption and the decryption works, the messages should stay confidential. So this is the very underlying principle of what we do here. But provable security has provable security has more to it. So, provable security, first of all, needs a definition of what security means. So in order to define what security means, yeah, please. Katz-Lindell in this case. So Katz-Lindell is this one here. And P means Pa Pelzel and Günesu. That's the other book. So on page 16 in the Katz-Lindell book, you find the information with more details on what provable security means. So first step for being methodological and systematic in provable security is that you should define what security means. So what are the components? What do you think, what we need to define for knowing what security means? There are basically three important aspects that I want to mention here, and in 2 weeks we have that even more detailed. So what does security consist of? What are the aspects that we would need to define? If we want to specify what security means. Yes?
Maybe one thing is that a clear text is not the kind of shown, or you cannot yeah, man kann den Klartext nicht rausfinden.
Okay.
Dann geht es darum, dass man die verschlüsselte Nachricht nicht manipulieren kann.
Okay. So those two things try to, so far, the only thing that we've seen is encryption. So you are talking about encryption here, and that's perfectly fine. Let's try to lift that on a higher abstraction layer. So what have you been talking about? What is the concept behind we want that encryption hides the plain text and that encryption protects the plain text from being manipulated on the wire? What is that more generally? Even more general. Yes, please?
I think it's called confidentiality and integrity.
Those are the actual compact terms for that. But what are confidentiality or integrity or authenticity or unforgeability or what is that? Yes, please. True, that's the specific answer to that. I want to have it lifted on a higher abstraction layer. So what is confidentiality? What class of concepts do confidentiality and integrity, authenticity belong to? Yes?
Are those security goals?
Those are security goals, exactly. So basically things that the adversary should not be able to attack, should not be able to break. Okay, so step one is goals of the adversary. That's not a nice. And examples for that are learning M from some ciphertext C, or impersonating Alice, and so on and so forth. What else do we need to specify if you want to define what security means? Yes, please. Yes. Looks like somebody either has a very good idea or took a look at the lecture notes from last year. Okay. Capabilities of the adversary. Very good. So what does that mean? Can you give me examples, or anybody? What could be capabilities of an adversary that we consider? Yes, please.
Maybe some would like computing power.
That will be the later on, not yet computing power. But keep that in mind. That will be relevant in a couple of seconds. Seen a couple of hands already, but I've seen a couple of hands never at all today. So everybody is welcome to raise their hands if they have a good idea, or even if they have an average idea. Yes, please.
Maybe forms of attack, such as the chosen matrix attack. That is sort of category.
Yeah, exactly. So can you elaborate on that? What does chosen plain text attack mean? So, can you put that in like simple terms? So, what I would, for example, say one capability of an adversary is, so we typically look at the internet, and on the internet, adversaries typically have the ability to observe ciphertexts, to just see ciphertexts, and even for known plaintexts. So we can. We can maybe know that this is a ciphertext that always carries the following message, and I know this is the known plaintext and this is the resulting ciphertext. So observing ciphertext is one part, or would be one example. Observing ciphertext, yeah. Another example would be, as you just said, knowing plain text parts, or knowing or choosing plain text parts. And something that we haven't talked about at all yet is, and I don't, yeah, please, go ahead. Could be something relevant, but actually for our formal perspective on cryptography, that's not really relevant, because we just believe that there are malicious entities on the internet, and we don't fully care about why they do that, we just want to protect against them. But yeah, it's a good point maybe to at least keep in mind what a possible motivation would be to make sure that we capture all the possible capabilities that are relevant or realistic. Yeah. So far we purely talked about malicious adversaries and strengths of our algorithms with respect to protecting against such adversaries. But our algorithms typically, so if you go to industry, the first question that they ask you, or the first problem that you have to solve, is not security. Security is typically the last step. So if you design an algorithm, what is the first thing that it needs to fulfill?
Efficiency.
Efficiency is then the second step. Yeah, there is something more fundamental that your algorithm should achieve. Yes. So you basically want, for the example of encryption, you want that the decryption gives you back the message that you encrypted. What is the fundamental, more abstract term for that?
Functionality.
Exactly. Functionality or correctness. And we need to specify that. That's important. That's also important for cryptography. We will learn why. Functionality of the protocol class that we're looking at. For example, delivering payload messages. So that was just the first step. So far we just specified in advance what do we want to achieve. Our algorithm should be functional, should just work, should just deliver the things from A to B if delivery is the thing that we're concerned with. The second step is then we want to take a look at possible adversaries on the network and want to get a realistic picture of what they can actually do. So they can observe ciphertext, maybe they can manipulate ciphertext, maybe they know parts of the plaintext, maybe they can even change and specify, select parts of the plaintext. And then the last step that's actually interestingly in reverse written down here, the last step is that we want to understand what could be a goal of the adversary or what would be our goal to protect. So we don't want that an adversary learns the message from a ciphertext. We don't want that an adversary is able to impersonate some honest user, Alice. Then the second step, when we want to prove security, is that we first of all specify our construction. There is not much to say about that. The better our specification, the more precise our specification, the better it will be deployed, it will be rolled out in practice, and the more closely, or the more specific our specification, the more closely the statements that we come up with our methodology here with provable security are linked to what's happening in practice. So if we just write down, there should be a K and some XOR and some message, and that results in the ciphertext, then a real implementer in our company that should implement that protocol doesn't really know what to do, so they just make up things, and at the end, they don't really follow the protocol specification for which we proved security. And so at the end, we do have a proof of security, but we have an implementation that diverges from that original specification. And then there might be attacks against the construction, although we had a proof of security. So specification, as clear as possible, is important. Third step for proving security is specifying our assumptions. So specify our computational assumptions. As I said a couple of seconds ago, in cryptography, we almost always rely on assumptions. And we have to specify what type of assumptions do we make. One set of assumptions is the existence of secure components. For example, we want to have, or we want to use a secure randomness generator. Or a secure cipher. And secure then again means that we also have to specify the security definition for that underlying component. So security again then with respect to the definition of a secure randomness generator. So with secure components, I mean cryptographic building blocks that we can use in a black box manner. So there is basically a cipher. We know what the inputs are. We know what the outputs are. We have a specified and fixed definition of security. We don't really need to know which cipher we use. So we don't really care if it is AES or, I don't know, TripleDES or whatever. As long as it gives us the security that we need, we are happy. And we just build it in a modular fashion such that we say, as long as we have a secure cipher and we use it here, we are happy. Sometimes we can't use such black box assumptions. Sometimes we have to rely on concrete hardness assumptions. So hardness of computational problems. And examples for such computational hardness assumptions are factoring, the discrete logarithm, or learning with errors. So all of these three assumptions will be part of this lecture, and we will understand what they mean. And now we come back to, I think you had that a couple of seconds ago, which was, we do not only specify the assumptions that we make on the building blocks that we use, but also on the capabilities, on the computational resources that an adversary has. Computational resources. Of users. And adversaries. And that includes runtime, memory, and resources like classical or quantum computers. For most of these things, especially for the computational assumptions, we can come up with more classes of assumptions that we can make. But the final part that we need for a methodology that we call provable security is what? So we started with what do we want to achieve? Definition of security. Then next step was what is the object that we are looking at, so the specification of our construction. So we have a goal, we have an object for which we want to analyze whether it achieves that goal, and then third is we specify what type of resources that object can use, what type of resources others can use, what is the final step that we want to do in order to achieve our goal of provable security of our analysis. What are we going to do? Maybe a too big question for, yeah?
Maybe like prove that under this circumstances the goals are fulfilled?
A proof of security. And the typical method for proving security in this course and generally in the literature is using reductions. Okay. This is the method that we are going to use in this course. And we will use the next the next session today and the next session next week to understand how we define security, what type of constructions we will look at, and the type of constructions will be more advanced throughout the course. We will understand what type of computational assumptions we will use, and basically at some point we will, for example, look at ciphers. We will specify ciphers, we will prove security for ciphers, and then at some point ciphers will be building blocks for larger protocols. So this will be basically a ladder of assumptions, of building blocks, of constructions that relate to each other, and at the end I hope that you have an idea of how cryptography can be built from smaller items to larger items. And the largest items are the ones that we use today to quickly motivate why the things that we look at are relevant. So, step two, TLS and the double ratchet. So just as a quick reminder, although I'm pretty sure that most of you know what TLS is. So TLS is in particular used whenever we are on the internet and we use something where HTTPS is part of our URL. But TLS is basically also always used when our signal messenger connects with the signal provider, or when our emails are downloaded from our email server. The long-term name, or the long name for TLS, is the transport layer security protocol. And currently, the used and newest version is version 1.3. There have been prior versions of TLS until SSL 2 point something. It was still secure socket layer. And then at some point we thought SSL or SSL secure socket layer was something very different, more based on heuristic arguments why things should be secure. And at some point when we thought, now we break the wall, we developed something very new, we developed something more secure, this thing was renamed to TLS, Transport Layer Security Protocol, and by now we are, as I said, in version 1.3. It is a standard. And although requests for comments are not considered or not formally specified as standards, inofficially, requests for comments, RFCs, are the de facto way of specifying standardized concepts on the internet, and the RFC for TLS 1.3 is 8446. And there are many other RFCs that specify parts of TLS 1.3, but the core RFC for TLS 1.3 is RFC 8446. The interesting part about TLS 1.3, in particular to older versions like 1.2 and others, is that it was developed in a large group of different stakeholders. Of course, the biggest stakeholder that was involved are the browser vendors. Of course, other people that were involved were standardization experts, But somehow new to the process of developing TLS 1.3 was that academics were involved too. So cryptographers, that while the protocol was still in development, in design, in discussion, on mailing lists and at conferences, cryptographers already wrote papers about early drafts of the standard. They tried to analyze the security, they tried to prove security with different methods, among others also with reduction-based proofs. And due to that, we today have a very foundational and good understanding of the guarantees that TLS 1.3 offers. So, last step is academics. Including cryptographers. And as I said, this is different from prior developments of TLS standards. So in TLS 1.2, for example, the first proof of security was published only after TLS 1.2 was standardized. During the entire development process of TLS 1.3, I guess around 5 to 10 papers have been published with security proofs of parts of the TLS standard. And for that reason, a couple of mistakes that have been made in the past have been avoided in the standardization of TLS 1.3. So summarized, it has been proven secure with reductions, but also with other tool-based approaches. I will come back in a second to the other slide. Just want to paste another image. So this here on the right is an image from a paper that analyzed TLS 1.3. And it basically specifies how a client and a server talk to each other in the TLS 1.3 handshake. So client starts to connect to the server, I try to connect to Wikipedia, and I say, hi, this is my client hello message, I do some cryptography with some HKDF, key derivation function. The server responds with some Y, which is G to the Y, some Diffie-Hellman share, also some randomness is sampled. Then I again use a key derivation function. Then these green colored things here are, as far as I know, encrypted parts, or is this just a name? I don't actually quite know right at the moment. Then there is some HMAC, so a message authentication code. There is some signature verification. There is some signature signing here. So all the cryptographic relevant parts are considered here, and all the parts that are not relevant for cryptography, they are excluded here. So as I said, we have some Diffie-Hellman operations, we have some key derivation function, we have again some Diffie-Hellman operations on both sides, key derivation functions, we have signing, we have message authentication codes, we have verifying, and so on and so forth. Again, signing, MAC, and so on. And your task in the exercise for until next week is to identify the components both of the TLS standard, but also of the second protocol that I will just quickly and briefly mention now, which is the double ratchet. As mentioned very early today, the double ratchet is the core component for deriving and computing secret key material, which is implemented in Signal
WhatsApp. iMessage,
and many other protocols.
In contrast to TLS, it is not really a standard because it wasn't developed by some standardization organization or by a larger group of people who tried to specify something for which they had a goal in mind, but rather it was developed by the developers of Signal. I will mention the people in a second.
But since it was deployed and developed in such a broad manner and implemented in so many messengers, we consider it the de facto standard of secure messaging.
The core developers back then were Trevor Perrin, and Moxie Marlinspike.
But as far as I know, Trevor is the big cryptographic head behind the two, and Moxie is more the application developer that was responsible back then. Although Signal was, or the double ratchet was specified without a standardization approach, today we have a long list of analyses and extensions by academia. In particular, iMessage today doesn't use the double ratchet as is anymore, but they developed an extension that uses public post-quantum cryptography. And also Signal very recently published a novel idea of how to extend the double ratchet with post-quantum cryptography. Okay, just to have it also in the script, I copy this second image. And this image here is taken from the documentation document by Signal that specifies how the double ratchet works and how key material is exchanged between Alice and Bob, so sender and receiver, and how further symmetric keys are derived. And yeah, I won't go into further details here because that will be basically your homework, looking at these documentations, understanding where and which type of building blocks, cryptographic components are used. So, the last couple of, 5 to 7 minutes today are a quick overview of the topics of this entire course. By the way, you are always encouraged to ask questions. So sometimes I may lose you. I think I have a somewhat good speed now since I practiced it last semester or last year already. But if there are questions, please feel free to ask. I think it's very important. If you have that question, typically you're not the only one who has that question. Yes, please.
I have a question on the double ratchet.
Yes.
This seems to me as an image or a picture of some fantastic, whatever device, gadget. So, what is the behind of the fantastic name, ratchet? Ratchet is something mechanical.
Yeah.
What is the?
That's a good question.
A little bit more detail.
Yes, sure, of course. So, just a reminder: the TLS protocol is basically something that is exchanges and establishes the symmetric key between Alice and Bob, who only know public information about each other, like a public key. And after that, this protocol establishes a channel, and then Alice and Bob can communicate with each other. But the key material in TLS, for example, when I access Wikipedia, I will just have some key, or I will establish a key first with Wikipedia, then use that key to continue to communicate until I leave the visit of Wikipedia or I end my visit of Wikipedia. In contrast, in messaging, I start a conversation with my communication partner, Alice, and I will continue to have that communication until I switch my phone or until, I don't know, my memory is corrupted or whatever. And that, in contrast to my Wikipedia visit, which takes like maybe 10 to 20 minutes, or maybe my Netflix session, which takes maybe 3 or maybe an entire binge-watching day. But in messaging, these sessions take like 2 years, 3 years, much longer. And the goal of the double ratchet was to make sure that if at some point somebody gets access to the key material on my phone, I still want that previous communication stays secure. So if, for example, I deleted some parts of my transcript or my traffic of my messages on my phone from last year, which were super secure, I am a journalist, I want to protect my sources and stuff, I want to be sure that if somebody gets access to my phone, I don't want to be using the same key material that I used 1 year ago. And also, if somebody for a very short time gets access to my phone, I want to make sure that after that access, if nobody has access to my phone anymore, I want to have secure keys in the future again. So these two properties, forward security, meaning that previous communication stays secure, even if somebody has access to my phone and knows the secrets, and post-compromise security, which means that after a compromise, I want to have a secure conversation again, that key material in the background is renewed, updated, and ratcheted. So the idea of the ratchet is that the key material slowly ratchets forward. You can't take it back, you can't reverse it. And also you add fresh information to that key update such that future key material will be unpredictable. That's roughly the idea. And if we look at that image here on the right side, we basically see, so the green and yellow parts, if you look at the document for your homework, you will see that these green and yellow parts, they are basically Diffie-Hellman key exchanges. And from such Diffie-Hellman key exchanges, we derive symmetric key material. And there is something like a sending chain and a receiving chain. And there are many other aspects that are relevant for the double ratchet that all feed into a somewhat complicated, interesting protocol for deriving and updating, renewing key material very efficiently and very quickly. That's roughly the high-level story. And everything else you can figure out in your homework. And we can discuss next week in the exercise session. Okay. But yeah, great question and very important to at least have a quick primer of what it is about. Yeah, thank you. Okay, so what will be the topics of this class? The first one is that we will look at key derivation. And we will also look at hash functions. And the idea of hash functions and key derivation functions and how they are defined are slightly different from the rest of the class. And so that's basically a filter of somewhat annoying and boring concepts. And after that, things become slightly more convenient. So everybody who wants to stay here, first of all, like in the first 2 weeks, we have to deal with these concepts and it will be slightly painful. But after that, things will become better and better. For example, a more practical and more understandable concept that we will look at in 2 weeks maybe is symmetric encryption. Then after symmetric encryption, we look at authentication. And this will be split into three sub-parts of authentication, sub-concepts of authentication. The first one is message authentication codes. So while symmetric, so first let's write down quick conceptual ideas.
So with key derivation, we basically derive one key from another because we think we need more keys or we need to need concept-specific keys. With symmetric encryption, we have something like a key and a message, and we derive a ciphertext from that. And then we have something like a key and a ciphertext, and we can derive back a message from that. With something like message authentication codes and similar concepts, we have something like a key and a message, and we derive a tag from it. And then, when we have a key, a message, and a tag, we can verify whether those three belong together or whether they do not belong together. So they basically, these three components together, they tell us whether somebody intended to send us this triple or this tuple of message and tag, or whether these two things have not been computed and established in the designated form. After we understood what message authentication codes are, we will learn how authenticated encryption works. And then we will level that up to digital signatures. After we finish that concept, this chapter, we will move on with public key encryption. For public key encryption, we start with simple constructions. We continue with simple primitives. Or even simpler primitives, something like key encapsulation mechanisms. And the final of complexity, the peak of complexity of the entire course will be post-quantum security. So after we reach the peak of complexity, we will dive more into the practical perspective of cryptography, and we will look at key exchange. So we basically come back to where we start with our motivation, TLS. And finally, we will look at secure communication. And if we have time at the end, we will slightly or shortly look at the use in practice. That's the outlook. At the beginning, you have to be a little bit patient, because those things, they are tedious, they are not simple, it's pretty hard to motivate why they are relevant, but once we see symmetric encryption, we see why these initial parts have been relevant. Okay, thank you very much for your attention, and we will continue in 10 minutes. Thank you so much.